I will try to give you a brief overview, brief review of selected fertility trends in Europe. This is a difficult task for some 10 to 15 minutes, so I have to be very selective, I have to be very broad, and if some issue comes up, we may get more into detail in the discussion at the end of the session. So usually low fertility in rich countries is perceived with very much mixed feelings, and we see many governments reacting in a negative way, and often media and general public reacting in a very negative way to the fact that there are decades of low fertility in many countries. Now, I would like first to emphasize that it's also a good news. It's a reflection of the fact that people, individuals, and couples have very good, effective control over their reproduction. That nowadays in rich countries, most people use highly efficient contraception, and the number of unwanted, unplanned pregnancies, though it is still significant, is smaller, lower than it was in the past. It also reflects women's empowerment and all the choices Alana was talking about. Nowadays, women are much more educated in rich countries, at least younger women, than men on average. There are very few countries in Europe, I think it's only Switzerland and Turkey, where women age 30 would have lower proportion of tertiary education than men around age 30. So this is a huge change in the life courses of women and men, and it's a normal thing for women nowadays, almost everywhere in Europe, to be involved in a labor market for most of their productive lives. So having children is still a very important aspect, but there are new things coming up, and they reflect widening choices and widening possibilities women and men have. Low fertility also means that parental resources are invested into health, well-being, skills, and education of the fewer kids that parents and couples have. Of course, there are all these negative things which are very obvious, which are discussed, and there are many publications which discuss that. There are all kinds of worries about the consequences, potential consequences for societies of very low or low fertility, which may prevail for decades. There are concerns about depopulation, which are actually quite strong and justified, especially in Central and Eastern Europe, in countries which face a lot of outmigration in the last 2-3 decades. So where outmigration combines with low fertility, this could be an issue of concern for the populations. And we have seen some Eastern European countries like Moldova and Latvia, Bosnia and Herzegovina, or Bulgaria shrinking by 15 to 20% in their population size in the last 25 years. There are also concerns about individual well-being of older people who don't have offspring, who don't have children, or who have only one child. Possible consequences about loneliness, limited possibilities of care for the elderly. But at the same time, of course, there are many ways how the economy and policies can adjust to these situations. There are many debates about the causes of low fertility, and of course, we have demographers have identified many of the factors which are behind low or very low fertility, and they include the economic conditions, the labor market conditions, the ability of couples and individuals to reconcile their career plans with their childbearing plans. But there are also factors and things and movements in fertility we don't yet fully understand and we don't have clear explanations about, and I come to that in a few minutes. There is quite a diversity in low fertility across the rich countries. So practically all rich countries, with the important exception of Israel, have low fertility rates. But there is a divide to some extent in these low fertility rates, and especially in Europe, it's the southern European regions and parts of southeastern and eastern Europe which have very low fertility. At least for the women born in the early 1970s and for most of the past 20 years, which let some demographers arguing that there is a new great divergence in fertility trends. However, period fertility rates are very unstable in the last decades, and they can change abruptly, partly because people have power to change the timing of their births, to influence the timing of their births. If many couples feel uncertain economic circumstances, uncertain conditions today, they can decide to have a child or to postpone the decision to have a child for another 1, 2, perhaps 3 years. The question is whether this decision is realized at all at the end of the day. But this power of deciding about reproductive choices means that period fertility trends often change from 1 year to the next a lot. And that's why we demographers often prefer looking at generational fertility or cohort fertility, if you like, looking at women who are close to finishing their reproductive careers, reproductive periods, looking at their family size, looking how many of them are childless, how many kids they had. Overall in Europe, we also have a long-term trend towards delayed reproduction. And this trend, I will show you, still continues. And I will also discuss a little bit, although there is not much time, the diverse policy responses to low fertility rates. Now, this graph tries to illustrate this huge these divides into low fertility, not only in Europe, but also in other rich and middle, some of the middle-income countries like China. And if you take period fertility rates, which are shown with the blue bars, or even if you take cohort generational fertility rates, which are shown in the green bars for the women born around 1974, you see the divide between East Asian countries with extremely low fertility. These are countries like Korea, Japan, and Taiwan. Also in China, Eastern Europe, Southern Europe, and the eastern part of Western Europe, which is meant German-speaking countries. Austria, Germany, and Switzerland have also relatively low fertility rates within rich countries. And on the other hand, Northern Europe, North America, Australia, and New Zealand having comparatively higher fertility rates, averaging close or around 2 children per woman. But the picture is more complicated if you follow period fertility trends. Especially if you look at the last 10 years, you see a lot of reorganization, a lot of shifts, ups and downs in this regional division in fertility rates across Europe. And some of these shifts, I have to say, are a bit unexpected and were not foreseen because fertility downturn in the countries and regions with somewhat higher fertility rates continued well beyond the recent, or not recent anymore, well beyond the economic recession, which took place around 2010. And even the Nordic countries with their wonderful family policies are facing quite some declines in their period fertility rates. The same happens in the United States. The same happens in some other Western European countries. In contrast, places in Southeastern, Eastern Europe, and also the German-speaking countries see increasing fertility rates in the last decade. Now, this is period fertility trends that may not reflect changes in family size. It may more reflect changes in the timing of childbearing. But it's an interesting trend, and we don't have clear explanation for that. At the extreme end of the spectrum, but this is not a European country, Republic of Korea has currently the lowest period fertility rates globally, and the Korean government is extremely concerned about that. Now, this is an example of some individual countries which have seen declining period fertility rates in the last decade, and you see almost all the Nordic countries, but also United Kingdom, Ireland, and some Western European countries like Belgium have seen quite some declines in their period fertility trends, getting much closer to the EU average, which is relatively flat in the last decade. In contrast, we have examples of countries with increasing fertility rates, including Austria, Germany, and some Eastern European countries. But you see also a lot of instability. Russia has had a tremendous increase in this period fertility indicator up to 2016, and then you see a small crash within 1 year following after that. So there is an instability in these trends. And We don't know fully what explains these unexpected fertility reversals and changes in the last decade, but perhaps suffices to say that we still see a continuing downward trend in fertility among younger women below age 25, and this downward trend has been particularly strong in countries which have seen fertility rates declining in the last decade. So it seems to be mostly a matter of changes in fertility timing rather than changes in family size. And this picture illustrates the continuing shift of childbearing towards ever later ages. It shows the mean age at first birth in selected countries in Europe and in Korea. And nowadays, Korean women are the oldest first-time mothers globally, having first child on average around the age of 31, which is far, far higher than three decades ago when they were on average around age 24, 25 when they had their first child. I already mentioned the continuing decline in early childbearing. This is an illustration for teenage fertility rates. Across the rich countries, teenage fertility rates, early childbearing is becoming really rare. Only a few percent of women in East Asia or in Western Europe nowadays have a child below the age of 20. And even in countries where this was an issue of policy concern, like in the UK or in the US, teenage fertility has been declining rapidly in the last 10 years. What doesn't change across the rich countries are the reproductive preferences. If you ask women, but also men, what's their ideal family size, what's their intended family size, number two scores very high, with about 6 out of 10 respondents consistently saying that 2 is an ideal family size. And if you pull different countries from different surveys in the last 3-4 decades, the number doesn't change. It's very, very stable. It's one of the most stable thing in demography and fertility research you can see. So fertility rates are unstable, but fertility preferences in rich countries, especially in Europe, seem to be remarkably stable in the last 3-4 decades. This picture, maybe you have difficulties to see what's inside, shows you the number of kids women have from the generation of women born around 1974 in different countries. And to make this message simple, the countries are ordered from country with highest fertility rate, United States, to the country with lowest fertility rate for that cohort, which is Spain, where Spanish women have something between 1.3 and 1.4 children on average. And the interesting thing is that these countries don't differ in the share of women with two kids. So in most of them, around 40% of women have two kids, and with some exceptions like in the US, this is really the most common family size for them. However, where they differ is that the lower the fertility in the country, obviously the fewer women with three and more children, and somewhat more childless women and more women with one child. So again, this shows very clearly this very strong two-child family orientation across different countries, across different low fertility contexts. Another trend I would like to mention very, very briefly is the long-term shift away from marriage, from having children within marriage, which still continues in most countries, but in not in all. It shows the proportion of children born outside wedlock, and the EU trend is very kind of regular and continuing, with about 40% of kids born outside marriage in the European Union nowadays. But you see also reversals in some Eastern European countries, like in Russia, and stabilization in some countries which used to have very high proportions, like in Sweden. So the trends are not the same in every country, but this gives us the message also for the policymakers. There are diverse family forms nowadays, and people have kids in diverse family configurations, and policies should take this diversity into account. Governments are concerned about low fertility. This is a number of governments in rich fertility countries which claim that their policy aim is to increase fertility rates out of, in total, 50 countries. And nowadays, about 35 governments claim that they aim to increase fertility with their policies, which is up from about 16 around the year 2000. So it's quite a bit of an increase. It's also a kind of delayed reaction to fertility declines back in the 1980s, 1990s. And There are policies which different countries try. Maybe I don't have to mention them or I don't have to read them, but I give some examples of different policies different countries are trying. Most countries have packages of many different policies in place, but they tend to put emphasis on different policy means. For instance, some Eastern European countries like Russia or Belarus or Ukraine are trying to boost family, trying to use boost financial incentives for women, especially for mothers with one or two children, to have another child. Other countries try to expand their childcare infrastructure, which has been the case in Germany, for instance, in the last 15 years. Other countries are expanding their parental leave schemes and making them much more flexible. This is the case of Germany and Austria, for instance, in the last 15 years. And many countries try to engage men more in their care for children, trying to give them extra months when they go for parental leave, or trying to dedicate special days on for paternity leave for the fathers. Now, this is also an illustration of these different policy supports. This graph shows how many percent of their GDP different governments in some selected countries give on family policies, broadly speaking, and how these policies are distributed or support is distributed between cash benefits, between services, and between tax breaks. And overall, in most countries, the family support has been increasing, and often the services, which means especially childcare infrastructure, has been expanded in many countries between 2001 and 2013, but we still see huge gaps between different countries, with, for instance, Spain or the United States providing much, much fewer resources for families than Sweden or France. Now, to conclude this talk, I put together something like a family policy checklist, where I would like to emphasize that policies need to be comprehensive. That means they need to be quite broad and catering for diverse preferences couples have. They need to be compatible with each other. If you have a policy to support women going back to the labor market, but you don't provide sufficient childcare, such policies may not be very helpful. And they need to be stable and predictable over time for the people and for couples. It's important to allow different options for people to combine, how they want to combine work, leisure, and childbearing. And since this is a discussion within the context of a UNFPA report, it's important to respect reproductive rights and choices. We have examples of attempts for coercive policies in the last decade, especially in some countries of Eastern Europe, for instance, where the government sometimes makes strong statements about what should be the preferred family size or how women, especially women, should behave in terms of their childbearing. And we think this is not the right context for making reproductive decisions. Finally, broader context matters. So we may have countries with wonderful policies, but if young people face economic instability, like, for instance, recently in Southern Europe, if the labor market doesn't function properly, probably they will not make reproductive decisions. Probably they will not have more kids than they used to have in the past. Thank you very much for your attention.